This is VOA News. I'm Alexis Strope. The combat between Israeli forces and Hamas, a U.S.-designated terrorist group, has displaced thousands of residents in southern Gaza. AP correspondent Norman Hall reports.
Gaza's health ministry says Israeli fire struck a crowd of people waiting for humanitarian aid at a roundabout in Gaza City on Thursday, killing at least 20 and wounding 150. The Israeli military says it was looking into the report. The toll from a strike the day before on a crowded shelter in Gaza rose to 12, with over 75 wounded. This woman, who gave birth days ago and can't locate her relatives, says she was present. A senior United Nations refugee official does not blame Israel, but says Israel is the only party to the conflict that has tanks. Thousands of people have rushed further south in recent days to escape the violence. I'm Norman Hall.
Jan Hoffman of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development said the impact of the Red Sea crisis on shipping costs and rates has been dramatic. VOA's Rick Pantaleo reports.
According to Jan Hoffman, head of the Trade Facilitation Section of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development, the crisis on the Red Sea weekly tanker ship transits are down 80%. Transit of ships carrying grain are down 6%, and gas carriers have stopped transit altogether.
Now, the impact of the Red Sea crisis on shipping costs and rates has been dramatic. The surge in the average container spot rate from Shanghai went up by plus $500, and that was the highest ever weekly increase.
Hoffman says ships have to travel through other routes, which increases the transit days and total transit costs, while also increasing greenhouse emissions. Rick Pantaleo, VOA News.
You'll find expanded coverage of world news and events 24 hours a day at voanews.com. This is VOA News. The economy grew at a surprisingly strong 3.3% pace in the last quarter of last year, the AP's Ed Donahue reports.
Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen says people are still spending despite high interest rates and high prices.
Wages have risen more than prices. Middle-class Americans now have more purchasing power.
In Wisconsin, President Biden looked at the GDP headlines.
U.S. shatters expectations. Second headline, the U.S. economy boomed in 2023. Third, U.S. economy grew at a shocking pace. I love that shocking pace.
The numbers show inflationary pressures continue to ease. The economy has been a drag on President Biden's poll numbers, but there are recent signs of improving consumer sentiment.
Though some forecasters thought a recession last year was inevitable, President Biden and I did not.
Former President Donald Trump has said the economy is horrible, except the stock market is going up. Ed Donahue, Washington.
North Korea says it's hosting a Chinese government delegation led by Vice Foreign Minister Sun Weidong as it continues its efforts to strengthen ties with Beijing and Moscow. State media said Sun's delegation arrived in Pyongyang on Thursday after crossing the land border between the countries. North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has been trying to boost the visibility of its partnership with China and Russia and strengthen his regional footing by joining a united front against the United States. At least 30 people have been killed and several others injured in Nigeria's Central Plateau State in a series of attacks around Mangu Town, Reuters correspondent Angela Johnston reports.
Survivors reported that gunmen indiscriminately shot at people, including women and children, and set fire to houses and property. The latest violence on Tuesday and Wednesday came after a Christmas Day attack in the area, which left at least 140 people dead. A dusk-to-dawn curfew was imposed on January 23rd. The MDA said in a statement that it blamed the attack on herders and questioned why troops deployed by the federal government to the area didn't intervene. A Nigerian defense spokesperson said the military remains neutral following allegations of partisanship in the conflict, adding that troops responded professionally. The latest attacks come amid a surge of violence in the plateau, which has seen repeated clashes between nomadic herders and local farming communities.
Angela Johnston from Reuters. Alabama has executed a man with nitrogen gas, putting him to death with a first-of-its-kind method that once again put the U.S. at the forefront of the debate over capital punishment. Officials said Kenneth Eugene Smith was pronounced dead at 8:25 p.m. Thursday at an Alabama prison. The execution came after a last-minute legal battle in which Smith's attorney said the state was making him the test subject for an experimental execution method that could violate the constitutional ban on cruel and unusual punishment. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, January 26th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. The founder and the leader of Zimbabwe's main opposition Citizens Coalition for Change resigns.
Chamisa himself has to be honest. He has to look at himself in the mirror for him to also take responsibility and culpability for what has been happening in the opposition in his CCC of late.
The former Speaker of Liberia's House of Representatives experiences his second election defeat. U.S. renewing calls to protect civilians following a deadly strike on a U.N. shelter in Gaza. Namibia's president to undergo medical treatment in Los Angeles.
We applaud the president for being very open to us as his people to inform us that he is sick and so that he can encourage other men to come out.
And non-profits say African food producers are enjoying rising revenues and better farm supplies. Those stories plus Samson Omalley's sports at the Africa Cup of Nations in Ivory Coast are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The founder and the leader of Zimbabwe's main opposition Citizens Coalition for Change, the CCC, has resigned. In a lengthy statement released on Thursday, Nelson Chamisa cited a long list of problems, including the ruling ZANU-PF's refusal to effect necessary political, constitutional, and electoral reforms. He also mentioned the recall of members of his party from parliament by politician Sigenzo Shabangu, who claims to be the CCC's interim secretary general. Chamisa said he will remain an active public servant and loyal citizen listener. Tendai Ruben Bufana is a Zimbabwe social justice advocate and writer. He tells me that Chamisa should have done a self-assessment of his leadership of the party and taken responsibility for any shortcomings.
He produced a long press statement in which he sort of tried to chronicle the events that took place from the time of the elections last year, in which there was a lot of irregularities and a lot of violation of the constitution, things that were also highlighted by SADC and the European Union observer missions that were here in Zimbabwe, such as, you know, the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission failing to provide the voters' roll, intimidation of voters, as well as, you know, state media, which was biased against the opposition. And then he was saying after the elections, we also saw the emergence of this Sengezo Shabangu, who claims to be the interim secretary general of the CCC, adding to an already compromised political situation in which elections were rigged. And after rigging the elections, he's alleging that then comes Shabangu. He recalls some of those few MPs from the opposition who had been elected by the people. So he also highlighted those as saying, hey, the party from then onwards was no longer in his hands. And you are saying that the CCC had effectively been captured or hijacked by ZANU-PF.
Okay, but let me ask you, because I interviewed Chamisa yesterday on this program. When I asked him about perceived problems within the CCC, he seemed to, as you said, to blame the ruling ZANU-PF.
We have to accept that the ruling ZANU-PF has been attacking the opposition, any opposition that it has felt threatened by. But Chamisa himself has to be honest. He has to look at himself in the mirror for him to also take responsibility and culpability for what has been happening in the opposition in his CCC of late. Remember in our previous interview with you, I did advise that Chamisa, what he needs now to do is immediately go for an elective Congress, get structures, leadership structures in place that are recognized and have a constitution that will be clear guidelines on how his party operates. He has not done that up to today when he's coming out now and announcing that he's leaving the CCC. Yes, he can announce that he has left the CCC, he has abandoned the CCC, he has ditched the CCC. But effectively, he was no longer in charge of the CCC.
So let me ask you now. He says in his statement that as a patriot, I remain active in public service. What do you suppose he's going to be doing now?
Unfortunately, that is a very vague and ambiguous statement. You know, he's not coming out clearly and say, is he going to form a new party? What is he going to do? Because that can mean anything. That could mean that he will continue just commenting, you know, on political activities that are happening in Zimbabwe and not being actually actively involved in the politics of the country. That could mean that. So it's quite possible that Chamisa is somehow actually retiring from politics altogether. It's quite possible. I'm not saying that's what's going to happen. We don't know.
Tendai Ruby Mbofana is a Zimbabwe social justice advocate and a writer. He was speaking with us from the capital, Harare. The president of Namibia is set to undergo medical treatment in the United States after a medical exam found the possible return of cancerous cells in his body, according to a news release from his office. Vitalio Angula reports from Windhoek, Namibia.
Having previously been diagnosed, treated, and cleared of prostate cancer, Namibian President Hage Geingob has again been diagnosed with the presence of cancerous cells after undergoing routine colonoscopy, gastroscopy, and biopsy procedures earlier this month. The CEO of the Cancer Association of Namibia, Rolf Hansen, told VOA the president has been open about his cancer diagnosis in the past. He said early detection and treatment played a huge role in Geingob's past treatment and recovery.
The scope that was done indicates that there might be cancerous cells in the soft tissue, perhaps the gut, the stomach, something like this. Mm-hmm. But until there is a formal prognosis by a doctor that has been publicly released, it's all speculation. And therefore, we also caution. We say, you know, this is a challenging time. Let us hear what the presidency wants to release.
Although President Geingob has been lauded for his transparency in terms of sharing his health status with the Namibian public, political analyst James Makua says Namibians would like to know more about what this latest diagnosis means.
What are the reasons and motives of the president's office sharing a diagnosis which has no prognosis? They are basically putting the country in a state of fear, to say the least, because you are telling us the person's diagnosis, but we have no clue what condition he's in, how is he doing, what is going to happen to him. We have no clue.
According to the media release issued by the presidency, the president accepted an offer from leading scientists and medical professionals in Los Angeles to undergo novel therapy for the cancerous cells. Dr. Elizabeth Kamati lauded Geingob for his openness in a country where cancer is stigmatized and men are known not to take their health seriously until it is too late.
So we applaud the president for being very open to us as his subject or his people to inform us that he is sick, and so that he can encourage other men who are also going through the same disease of cancer, which is somehow a taboo in our society, to come out and tell them cancer is real. Diagnosed with cancer does not mean a death sentence.
The president has come under harsh criticism in the past for seeking medical treatment abroad. However, Namibian doctors acknowledge that cancer treatments are relatively specialized and the country does not have the equipment and medical expertise to treat the disease effectively. Vitalio Angula for VOA News, Windhoek, Namibia.
Last October, the National Elections Commission of Liberia declared Anthony Williams the winner over the Speaker of the House of Representatives, both all chambers, in the Plibo Sodokan District No. 2 elections. Chambers appealed to the Supreme Court, citing several discrepancies. The court ordered the commission to rerun the election at two polling places in the district. Voting took place yesterday on Thursday. Williams called VOA Thursday evening to say he had defeated the former speaker for the second time.
I've won the election again for the second time. We know we went to the elections on October 3rd. Buffer Stimmer was defeated, and then yesterday he said no. And the Supreme Court of Liberia decided to make a decision in favor that our people in Plibo Southern District felt disappointed, and they thought that it was important that they go back to the pool and correct or embarrass the Supreme Court and Buffer Stimmer's and that which was done today.
By what margin now? Because the first round was very close.
The margin this time, for example, in polling place one, I got 350, and he got 75 in polling place one. In polling place two, he got 47, and I got 321. So if you add it, you know that I got 671, and then you have around, I think, 122. So if you do the analysis, you get to know that I've gone up, I think, I'm leading out of 85-vote margin.
So how do you feel, and what do you do now from here?
Well, like I was saying, the lesson learned is that it just sends a message to everybody, not just only Buffer Chimas, that when you are defeated, you should learn to accept your defeat with honesty. You should not challenge the decision of the people, because the people are the one who voted for you. So if they arrive at a conclusion and they thought that it was better and to let you go, it is just fair enough that you respect the decision of the people and not to challenge it. So that is the case of Buffer Chimas. He was elected for the past 18 years, and our people thought that this year it was good that they let go of him, and he said no. So it's just a step where it is not good to challenge the decision of the people. If you challenge it, it will come back into your face. That's what just happened to Buffer Chimas.
So briefly, Anthony, before I let you go, what is your plan going forward as a new member of the House of Representatives?
Well, I got some plan going forward. Is first of all, try to go to the National Legislature to get when you are elected by your people. The National Election Commission must certificate you, and therefore there will be a formal program now at the National Legislature to have me inducted into the 55th National Legislature. From there, then we can now start the work of the people of People's Organ District and the people of Liberia.
Anthony, congratulations for your second victory.
Thank you so much, James. I'm always happy to be on your radio. Thank you so much.
Anthony Williams is the winner of a rerun election with former Liberian Speaker of the House of Representatives, Beaufort Chambers. He was speaking with me from Plibo, southeastern Liberia. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, January 26th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley Sports. Climate change has hit African farmers and food processors hard in recent years, making agriculture, the raw farm products that food companies depend on, more unpredictable. However, an organization that promotes food security in Africa says farmers and processors are creating a more resilient food system by adapting to the new climate and creating better infrastructure to minimize losses after the harvest. Mohammed Yusuf reports for VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi.
Over the years, international organizations partnering with experts, food processing companies and governments have worked to educate farmers on how to produce crops amid ever-changing technology and unpredictable weather patterns. A non-profit organization, Partners in Food Solutions, says that due to those efforts, African food processing companies are now starting to reap real rewards. The organization's recent report says over 200 food companies they collaborated with in the past year saw growth in their income, the workforce and the food supply they receive from farmers. Tropical Lush, a fresh fruit juice producing company in Kenya, is one of the companies that has received the support of PFS over the past 10 years. Adras Shah is the head of Tropical Lush. He says the company has increased revenue by 15% and often adds 5 to 10 casual workers to its 30-person staff to meet demand. He credits his company's growth in part to local farmers, who he says have increased both their quality and quantity.
Even though the global warming and rains and all that kind of stuff is affecting the produce, however, I'm finding that we are generally able to get much more better quality and more reliable supplies in our fruits from the farmers. And it's happening quite well, according to me. Better farming technique, a lot of better knowledge now. The farmers are able to access with smartphones and etc. They're able to predict weather patterns. They're able to see themselves, soil fertilizer. All those little things are probably now adding up and helping to benefit the farmer directly.
PFS, which is headquartered in the U.S., provided expertise from food industry giants like General Mills, Hershey and Cargill to help African processors with business strategy, growth, sourcing food safety and quality, storage, branding and marketing. The organization says the companies it supports have increased their revenue by an average of 20% and increased food supply from farmers by 50%. John Kiragu is the regional program director for East Africa.
We have managed to transfer the know-how of food and expertise of global food companies into Africa, and we have seen it work. So the 8 global food companies that support us as PFS and directly support the food companies in Africa have shared 800 years of combined expertise. And we are sharing with a company that, say, is 3 years. So you can imagine how long they would have taken to get to a point where they can, you know, learn organically about this technology, about the way of doing business.
Shah says his company sought advice on how to grow the company and manufacture quality products.
So whenever we have an issue with shelf life, temperature, cold chain, we want to make a new product or new product development, there's always somebody out there who they can put us in touch with within a month, and we start chatting to them and they help us.
Along with farming issues, African food companies often have to deal with inadequate harvesting methods, poor infrastructure, and a lack of proper packaging and storage facilities. The FAO says sub-Saharan Africa experiences food losses as high as 50% for high-value commodities in between production and retail. Kirago of PFS says the organization is working with food producers to improve food handling practices, upgrade shipping, and enhance storage facilities for agricultural produce.
PFS is to make sure that...
Mohamed Yusuf, VOA News, Nairobi.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Thursday renewed his calls to protect civilians following a deadly strike on a U.N. shelter in Gaza that the world body attributes to Israeli tank shelling. Blinken's call came amid reports that Israeli fire struck a crowd of Palestinians waiting for aid. White House Bureau Chief Patsy Vadikeshwara has this report.
At least 20 people killed and 150 wounded by Israeli strikes on a crowd waiting for humanitarian aid in Gaza City, according to Gaza health officials. Israel says it's investigating. Meanwhile, Israeli troops continue their advance in Khan Yunis as thousands of Gazans flee from the city. Safety is elusive. According to the UN, 13 were killed and dozens injured Wednesday after Israeli tank shells struck a facility housing 43,000 Palestinian refugees. In Angola, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called for such facilities to be protected.
We've reaffirmed this with the government of Israel, and it's my understanding that they are, as is necessary and appropriate, looking into this incident.
Israel suggests that the building housing refugees was hit by a Hamas rocket. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is going ahead with plans to establish a buffer zone along the border with Gaza that he says will protect Israeli communities from Hamas attacks. Netanyahu said, "Hamas came to annihilate us. We will annihilate them. We will deepen our roots in our country. We will uproot our enemies. We will be here and they will not be there."
Hamas came to annihilate us. We will annihilate them. We will deepen our roots in our country. We will uproot our enemies. We will be here and they will not be there.
The U.S. does not support a buffer zone that would include Palestinian territory. The plan could widen the rift between Israel and its staunchest backer. Robert Blecker, director of the Future of Conflict Program at the International Crisis Group.
The level of frustration in D.C. is increasing, and part of that has to do with Netanyahu publicly and specifically rejecting requests that the U.S. has made. I'm sure it doesn't feel good in Washington to be giving almost unlimited support, unconditional support to what Israel is doing, and then to have the prime minister of the country effectively spit in your face.
Israel has already rejected Washington's push for the creation of a Palestinian state once the war is over, prompting a warning from UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
This refusal and the denial of the right to statehood to the Palestinian people would indefinitely prolong a conflict that has become a major threat to global peace and security.
In the bloodiest months of the decades-long conflict, Palestinians estimate nearly 26,000 people have been killed by the military campaign in Gaza since October 7, when Hamas attacked targets in Israel, killing 1,200 people and taking 240 others hostage. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken on Thursday voiced hope for greater diplomacy to bring lasting peace to the Democratic Republic of Congo's troubled east following the vast country's elections. According to the French news agency, the AFP, Blinken discussed the conflict with Angolan President João Lourenço, whom the top U.S. diplomat said was trusted by all sides and played an essential role in mediation. It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in the Abidjan, Ivory Coast. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the latest update from the 34th edition of the Africa Cup of Nations being hosted by Cote d'Ivoire. The group stage of the 2023 AFCON were concluded on Wednesday night, setting up some highly anticipated knockout stage clashes, which begins on Saturday. The group stage produced stellar shocks, goals, records, history, and passionate fans turning up at match venues. With sudden death marches between some of Africa's top sides, the round of 16 promises pulsating action and drama as heavy favorites and plucky underdogs collide. I spoke to Patrick Gillard, a French journalist covering the tournament here in Cote d'Ivoire, and he told Daybreak Africa Sports what fans should expect from the knockout pairings.
I'm really curious to watch Nigeria versus Cameroon because, you know, these are two giants of continental football, so we'll have to know what they can do in the knockout stages, which is different from the group phases. The second one, of course, and maybe the most attractive one, is Senegal versus Côte d'Ivoire, because Côte d'Ivoire is a miracle team. They could have been out. They're still alive, and they're going to play the defending champions. So if could you imagine a better game in the organizing country? Then you'll have a big West African derby between Mali and Burkina Faso. You have an interesting game between Morocco and South Africa, especially if you remember that 6 months ago South Africa beat Morocco in Johannesburg, so that's quite interesting.
Former African president of the International Association of Sports Journalists, Michel Obi, says the 2023 AFCON has become as unpredictable, unlike what was obtainable in the past.
I'm happy that some of the countries we never really gave a chance are forcefully finding their way and making one to believe that it's still very open to all, although very close to call. African football has shown that it defies logic, and you can never use all the pundits' extrapolations or the pundits' calculation to come to a fitting outcome.
Staying with the 2023 AFCON, the head of referees and technology at the Confederation of African Football, Desire Numandis Duo, says the referees taking part in this edition of the Africa Cup of Nations represent the cream of the crop of the continent. A total of 68 referees, assistant referees, and video assistant referees are officiating matches at the 2023 AFCON.
So we are in a continuous process of scouting, of evaluating, and of selection. And now you know that we have different stages. Okay, you start young talent, then you go elite B, then you go elite A, then you go professional among the best, and it's among the elite A we pick from the AFCON.
And that's it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abidjan, Cote d'Ivoire. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a great weekend. And that's it for this Friday, January 26th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.
United Nations says almost one in three women continue to be subjected to physical and or sexual intimate partner violence at least once in their lives. On this week's edition of Our Voices, we will discuss whether existing laws on violence against women are effective enough to criminalize forms of domestic violence in sub-Saharan Africa. Join the conversation Wednesdays